You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
If you own that dog, you are a dog trainer, and every dog is different, so you can't try to force that dog into the pages of a book or into a podcast or whatever. Like, that dog is a unique individual. So the things that I say, the things that people write, generally speaking, they will typically work, but there's always going to be one-offs, right? And as a dog trainer, and if you're a dog owner, you're a dog trainer, you do have to be able to adapt to the dog in front of you. So you may have a dog that really doesn't have a lot of drive. It just naturally, it does not have a lot of drive. And if you start putting too much control in that dog at a young age, it may be really hard to get that dog to hunt how you want it to later on.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocky Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. My guest today is Jordan Horek. Jordan is known as the Dog Whisperer of Cocker Spaniels, and he's the maker of the Cato Board, a training place board for all breeds of dogs. Jordan and I discuss the training differences between pointers and spaniels, males versus females, and why that extra X chromosome is superior. Creative. Jordan shares some great insight on training, hunting, and living with different types of bird dogs. This episode is a must listen. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, Pro Plan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28 gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on Patreon.com/TheBirdDogBabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer season hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Also by Big Frig, roto-molded coolers with heavy-duty latches, dual stainless steel lock plates that double as bottle openers. They also have dry boxes, tumblers, and growlers, and my favorite, the ability to customize the tumblers and coolers. Head to thebirddogbabe.com/bigfrig to view the wide array of sizes and colors available. There's a Badlands cooler perfect for your way of life. Hey, Jordan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Courtney. Glad to be here.
So I wanted to hop on an episode with you. You and I have talked here for the last, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so-ish about a couple different things. We have started incorporating the Cato Outdoors boards into our personal training program, and they rock. So congratulations on, you know, I mean, I think the concept of place training has been there, but you really gave us a tool to utilize that in a no-brainer, very efficient way.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. Like, it's not like I invented anything. It's not rocket science. There were a lot of people doing place training for the last 20 or 30 years, and they used a lot of different homemade contraptions to do it. And I just saw so many people starting to adopt that type of training with no good commercially made product. And I thought, well, I can't believe nobody doesn't design something, and nobody did. So finally I did it. And it's been great, because the hunting dog market has been really receptive to it. But outside of that, it turns out almost like every sort of dog discipline out there uses platforms for training. So it's being used by the military and police departments and agility trainers and obedience and fitness, and just a simple tool, but a lot of people are using it. So it's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, so a long, long time ago, I actually took my puppy, an Irish setter at that time, through a local obedience class. And okay. It was Robin McFarlane at That's My Dog.
I know Robin. And,
right. I think, yeah, you had said that, like, you guys kind of, because she taught me, you know, with the puppy training, she used that place concept as a foundation right away. And so that's kind of a neat little link that you have as well with Robin.
Yeah.
Did you bounce some ideas off of her for that?
So when I actually did go and meet with Robin, because my parents are down in Iowa, I'm up in Wisconsin, she's kind of in the middle. So once I'm on the way down to see my parents, I stopped by and I had a prototype that I'd had 3D printed that I showed to her, and it bounced some things off of her. It's got her input, made a few little changes based on her input. And so she was a little bit involved in the design for sure.
Mm-hmm. Cool. It's a small world.
Yeah. It is, isn't it?
Yeah. But also in the Spaniels. So how long have you had the English Cocker Spaniels?
So it seems like I've had them my entire life, but my oldest Spaniel is also my first Spaniel, and she is, she turns 13 this summer. So she's like 12 and a half right now.
Okay. You've since like won what, several different field championships?
I mean, I like, I mean, I'm just the guy that likes dogs and has put a lot of time into them, but I've had a few good ones in that time. So, and it's a long story, but I went through a lot of dogs looking for what I wanted, probably to make up for my bad training. I don't know. But I learned a lot about training by having different dogs and different personalities. And you know, I had a pro trainer tell me a long time ago, probably 10 years ago. I guess that's a long time for me. It's all relative, right? But about 10 years ago, a trainer said, you've got to train about 50 dogs before you can really call yourself a pro, like before you really know what you're doing. And I took that to heart, and I have gone past the 50 dog mark probably a couple of years ago. But I got that first cocker and I really liked her. And then I got another one and I liked him even more. And then I made a little drive a couple hours from home and came back with three more cockers. And it was like a disease. They just started to accumulate. And my wife just put up with it. I have no idea why. Because looking back, like that was, it was crazy because I was in way over my head. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I had too many dogs, but I put a lot of effort into it. And I started field trialing in the fall of 2014. And I hunted a lot before then, and I still hunt a lot now, but I added on the trialing in that fall of 2014, and then went to the Nationals in Michigan the next fall. And I took third with a dog named Breeze that I still have. And then a couple of years later, I won the amateur Nationals with Breeze. And then that fall of 2018, I won the Open Nationals with Cato. So, and then I've had a few others along the way that have done some things as well. So a lot of it just, it's good dogs and, you know, it's time and having the dogs. Like that's really what it comes down to.
Kind of what sparked my really interest in having a conversation with you is a couple days ago. I've been very, and a lot of listeners know I'm really interested in adding a small dog to my team. Having a little flusher for the area that we live in would be really ideal. And I've gone between the Boykins and the Cockers. And I mean, can you kind of give me a little bit of is it possible for you to give me an unbiased opinion of going between those two?
I mean, I'm really familiar with Boykins and I own like 10 Cockers. So that, I mean, it's probably okay. Not going to be possible to be unbiased, but the Boykin has some Cocker in it. They used it when they were developing the breed. Okay. And I think if your primary focus is a retrieving dog, I think the Boykin could be, I don't even want to use like adjectives for this, but I think the Boykin would be good for that. I had one Boykin in here for training that I really liked. He's a really enthusiastic retriever. He's a little bit harder headed than most of the Cockers, maybe not all of them. The Cockers generally are going to be flashier in the field. Like if you're using them for upland hunting, a good Cocker, is that a good Boykin is not going to be able to keep up with a good Cocker in the uplands. I know there's going to be listeners that I'm definitely not trying to step on any toes. And I know there's some really, really good Boykins, but, the Cockers, I would say, were more developed for upland hunting. And that was their primary thing, finding, flushing, and retrieving. And the Boykins were more developed for retrieving. You know, they're almost like in some ways, like a miniature retriever, right? Like a Labrador. They're not really, but retrieving was a big part of the Boykins' development. And even now, like in the trials that they have, they really focus on retrieving, although they do have an upland portion as well. So I don't know. I mean, I know you got all types of listeners and I sure don't want to step on toes because I think they're both real nice dogs, but
yeah,
but
no,
the Cockers.
So, yeah. Yeah. And what about, I mean, what's your input as far as water work between the two breeds? Is one going to be more water loving than the other? If I want to do some duck hunting.
So I don't think that you'll find really any difference as far as water enthusiasm. I mean, I've come across a few Cockers that maybe don't love the water, but I think some of that was development. or environment. And then I've had others that just, they're like little muskrats. They see water and they just go and swim, right? And, and regardless of the temperature, sometimes they'll do that. But I do think from what I've heard, and this is really only hearsay, because even the Boykin that I had in for training, it wasn't in the wintertime. But my understanding is that the Boykins are a little bit better suited for cold water duck hunting. So I think that they have the leg up in that. But I'm not an expert on both breeds. I mean, the closest thing I'm an expert to is on the Cockers.
Okay.
So
no,
I definitely don't want to paint the Boykins in an unfair light, since
I think they have enough hype in the breed right now that they're doing just fine without taking offense to it.
I just want to be careful that, because I have nothing against them at all. So I don't want people thinking, oh, he hates Boykins. And that's far from the truth.
Yeah. No, it's like asking me, would you rather have a short hair or a wire hair? You know, I just think, right, there's positives to all the different breeds. It's just kind of needs to be narrowed down to what you specifically are looking to get out of it and do with it.
And for 99% of the people out there, you're not going to change their mind. Like, if they like Boykins, they're going to like Boykins no matter what anybody says. And if you like Cockers, they're probably going to like Cockers no matter what anybody says.
Right. Right.
Just like pointers and setters, right?
Yes, exactly. So. Yes. So in the pointing dog world, we have kind of a different means of setting, I don't know if you want to say foundations and such, but in our conversation the other day, when I was talking to you about touching in and getting another, or touching in again about getting a Cocker puppy this year, you had asked what I was looking at for timing. And I said, well, I would like it to be around 6 months old by the time rough grouse season starts here, which is September. So I'm like, yeah, I guess born in March would be ideal. That, you know, give or take a little bit, a month for flexibility. And so for pointing dogs, for us, that's what we like to do. You know, at 6 months old, we like to get them out there, get them the experience, get them into birds. And then later on, you know, when season's over, then we start going into the foundations and the obedience and such. Because for pointing dogs, a lot of them get taught by the wild birds, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you had advised me against that and saying it would be more ideal to wait until a Cocker is a year, two, and a year, a half year old before I take it hunting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of stopped you in the conversation there. And I said, okay, nope, we need to get this. we need to record this, because I don't know. And it's different from anything I know. So I want my listeners to be able to catch in on it too. So dive in, sure. Jordan, tell us what that's about.
Okay. Yeah. So I get pretty passionate about this. So you'll have to like cut me off and interject as you want more, but I'll just, once I get on a roll with this, it's hard
roll
to
it.
Stop. Okay. So there's the adage that everybody knows is it takes birds to make a bird dog, right? And I mean, I hear that. I used to hear it all the time, maybe not quite as much now, but that definitely is really prevalent within the hunting dog community. It takes birds to make a bird dog. And in my opinion, that adage has ruined so many flushing dogs. Maybe pointing dogs too, I don't know. But flushing dogs, for sure. Because when you think about what a pointing dog is supposed to do, it's supposed to hunt within range. It's supposed to find birds, flush them, and retrieve them back to hand, right? Like that's the, now duck hunt or waterfowl hunting, that would be different, but in the context of upland hunting, that's all we're looking for. Hunt within range, find birds, flush them, and retrieve them back to hand. And there might be, we might ask for more things depending on what level we're training to. Like we may ask them to be steady to the flush. We may ask them to honor other dogs. We may ask for a cleaner retrieve back to hand. But at its core, find, flush, and retrieve, and find within gun range. And I can think back to, so I'm 38 years old now. And when I was a kid, I pheasant hunted almost every day in Iowa, which is where I grew up. And I had a lab. My brother had a lab. My dad had a golden retriever. We had friends that had a couple of springers. You know, it was all flushing dogs. And literally in like a decade of pheasant hunting in Iowa, I never hunted over a pointing dog. It was all flushers. And I have so many memories of dogs out of control, like just out of control, maybe in control till the first bird flew. And then after that, whistling and yelling and walking fast, maybe even running, trying to keep up with the dog, trying to keep it within range, like trying to like pretty like stressful and hectic. And like, I remember like flat out being angry at my dog sometimes because he was such a knucklehead. Cause he would get on a bird and just go, or maybe he wasn't even on a bird. Maybe he would just go cause he wanted to find a bird, and it had nothing to do with hunting within range. It had nothing to do with hunting with me. It was just, he was all about finding birds, that lab that I had. And ironically enough, his name is Cato. That was my first dog. And then I reused the name later on, but that's neither here nor there. But that was my like upbringing with flushing dogs, chaos. When I was introduced to the Spaniels, and then I ran across a couple people who field trialed, and I started to formulate different opinions, I started to realize more and more that with a flushing dog, it really is more a discipline of obedience than it is anything else. So like a pointing dog, maybe, and it really just depends on region too. So if you're out west, maybe that pointing dog is 300, 400, 500, 600 yards away from you. If you're in the grouse woods, it's maybe 100 yards or right. 70 yards away from you. So it kind of depends on region. Mm-hmm. But with the pointing dog, you're really looking for a lot of bird sense, like go out, run objectives, find birds, you know, do whatever you got to do to find birds, and then I'll come and flush it for you, right? And so I could see with the pointers where getting them lots of bird exposure, giving them that bird sense so they know how to really run the objectives in a big area would be super important. But with the Spaniel, I really don't want them more than 20 to 30 yards away from me at any point. So there's going to be like micro objectives, we could call them, inside of that 20 to 30 yards. And I for sure some Spaniels are way better at hunting those micro objectives and producing birds within that, say, 40 yard swath that you're taking with that dog. There's some that are much better than others, but it's not the same as running 600 yards away and finding a bird. It's cover this 40 yard swath, hunt the objectives within that swath and find birds for me. Well, if you can't hunt, there's not a lot of margin for error. So a pointing dog, if it's running 400 yards away, or 600 yards away, and I don't know how far your dogs run. Maybe that's farther or less, but we'll just throw it out there. Say four
yeah,
to.
I like them closer, but yeah, they can be out there in the open country on the prairies, right?
And even if we say 50 yards or 100 yards, that's still a 50 yard difference, but that doesn't really matter too much with a pointing dog. But with a flusher, your margin of error is really small. Like, if it fluctuates by 50 yards, that means your dog is 20 yards or 70 yards away from you. And that doesn't work. Right. So, So really like there's not a lot of margins for error with that dog getting too far away from you. Like really it needs to be within gun range all the time. And gun range for most people is really, they need to be shooting that bird within 45, maybe 50 yards for most people. Right. So that dog really needs to be within 25 yards if it's producing the bird off its nose. So the obedience becomes really, really important. If you can't keep that dog in range, it's going to lead to a frustrating hunt. And I guarantee you have a lot of listeners with flushing dogs who have had some really frustrating experiences watching their flushing dog go down the field, putting up birds, whether it's at a game farm or with wild birds, the dog's out of range, putting up birds. And the handler is just kind of along for a walk because none of the birds are being put up in range. So,
as I say, I know plenty with pointing breeds thing. That had the same frustration. So,
yeah. But that's a different. Like that dog needs to learn how to to actually hold birds, right?
Right. Right.
The flusher just needs to learn to don't go out there and flush that far away. Just wait till we get there, and then you still get you. So when I develop these dogs, one, I'm looking. I mean, I'm gonna get a breeding that's proven. You know, I'm not going and buying something from the pound and hoping that it likes birds. And nothing against dogs from the pound at all. That's just not what I do. But I'm buying a dog that I know that pedigree. I know the parents for sure. I probably know back three or four generations, and I know those dogs were natural bird dogs. So I'm not really worried. Like, I have a couple, my daughter and I have three puppies here right now that are maybe 12 or 13 weeks old right now. And I am not worried at all about, will they like birds? Will they retrieve birds? Will they have good noses? Will they be able to find birds? Like, that's there. And when we want to open up that can, we'll open up that can. But before we get there, what I really want is for those dogs to be focused on me. I want to be like the center of their life. You know, I want them to like love me, have a really good recall, have a really good sit. I don't want them out there just learning on their own and figuring out birds without me in the picture. I want them to like find those birds with me and be working with me. So my training really is geared toward that, for that first, you know. And I think when we had our short conversation, I said, better to wait till they're like a year or a year and a half old before you hunt them. But yep. The reality is it's not necessarily an age as much as it is a stage in the development. So I'm not going to let my dogs retrieve a bird until I know they'll come when I call them. Because the last thing I want is for, let's say, a 4 or 5 month old puppy to go out and retrieve a bird. And let's just say this is just in training. Maybe I throw a dead pigeon out there or a clipwing pigeon, and the puppy runs out and grabs it. And the puppy looks at me because I'm calling it. And then it looks off in the distance and says, huh, if I head that way, maybe I can eat this thing before he catches me. And I've seen this happen, right? The puppy grabs the bird and says, shoot, I don't want to give this thing up. Like, this is lunch, like the best lunch I've ever had, right? Why would I go give it to that guy? And the puppy takes off. And then now all of a sudden, like, let's say it was with a clipwing pigeon. Well, now the puppy starts pulling feathers out of it, and it's like it just leads to a bad experience. So when I give a puppy a bird for the first time, I want to have a really a pretty good idea that dog has a good enough recall built into it that when I call it, it's going to come to me with the bird, and it's not going to take off running. Because I want that first experience with the bird to be positive. I don't want to be chasing it around, trying to catch it, yanking the bird out of its mouth. None of that. So that development is, let's make sure we have a good recall. Let's make sure it sits. Let's make sure it understands the whistle. And then let's start to put it into more of a sterile environment, almost a more controlled environment. Okay. Is with hunting, I mean, you hunt a lot, you know this, it gets, it's not sterile. Like, things happen. Like, a bird flies up over here, and now a bird flies up over there, and the dog goes out on a retrieve, and another bird flies up, and it can get chaotic really quickly when we're hunting, which is great. I mean, that's what makes hunting fun, right? But if you have a puppy that already isn't very well trained, and then stuff like that starts to happen, all of a sudden that puppy is chasing birds all over the place, and you see the eyes kind of start to roll back in the head because it's so excited, and it's like they go crazy, right? Because it's like crack cocaine to them. I mean, like, they become addicted to it, and they lose their minds, and they just want more of it.
And all of a sudden, you got door. Yeah,
everything goes out the door. So I try to avoid that as much as possible, because I really, and this is why I tell clients clients coming here for training, like, we always want to play from a position where we can win. We don't want to play from a position where we're likely going to lose. So there's a great chance if I go out hunting with a dog that's poorly trained at best, that I'm going to lose. Mm-hmm. And I would rather like break it down into steps so I can win each step along the way and never have to like play from a position of losing, if that makes sense.
It does. It's just like, this is so, it's the Spaniels are very, I would say, role reversal from the pointers in that respect of training, because, you know, in the pointing breeds, we don't even have to, if you're looking at for testing purposes, we don't work on that retrieve. We don't need a retrieve until they're a mature, you know, usually 1.5, 2 year old dog. And
okay.
So, and like, I even listened to a podcast last week where a very well-known trainer, field trial horseback trainer, was saying, like, don't teach your dog any obedience until it's 2 years old, because you want it to be very independent. You want it to stay out there and not want to come in and lock eyes with you. And, you know, mm-hmm. So that's, it's a totally different game. But it's interesting because we've been doing, like, with our puppies, once they turn 8 weeks old, they're working on obedience right away. They're structured. They know that the Kato board, we're doing like retrieving courses right now. And these puppies, I say puppies, I mean, they're like 6 to 9 months old, but they are the most comfortable in this retrieving drill that we're doing with all these different dogs, because their base is starting on that Kato board. And they're just transitioning really well. They're comfortable up there. They know I get rewards here. I do good things here. And, you know, versus the ones that, like, my Bracco is 2.5 years old. I never really spent much time doing that place training with him. And he gets up there and he's more nervous. Like, where do you want me? Where should I go now? And he's really questioning himself that,
yeah.
You know, versus that 6 month old puppy that's like, I'm right here. Let's do it. Let's work. Let's go. I'm ready.
So yeah. Yep.
It's interesting, but go ahead.
I was gonna, maybe the pointing game will evolve a little bit, mm-hmm. and I say game, but like maybe that type of training, because I know, I mean, guys have used barrels and things like that. I don't think there's been a lot of platform training with pointing dogs in the past, and I think that's probably gonna evolve a little bit.
Right.
But that's, yeah, I don't. I can definitely see the contrast, because the pointers, it is like, let's let them go. Let's let them go. Mm-hmm. And the Spaniels, it's
right.
The Spaniel. I mean, I don't know how much you've hunted behind flushers, but
not much.
It's not fun to hunt. It's not fun to hunt behind a flusher that's running wild. And
yeah.
Once they start running wild, it's much, much harder to reel them in. Mm-hmm. Than it is to, like, let's say take a dog that's 6 months old or 8 months or 10 months old, and maybe it doesn't quite know how to get out and hunt yet, but it really loves you and it wants to be with you. Like, we can open up a dog like that real quickly if we need to.
Okay.
But the ones that are out of control, when you start trying to reel them, it's so much harder to reel them in.
Right.
And it starts more pressure, and you know, it's not a fun process.
Mm-hmm. So when you're getting them in later, the dogs that haven't had that solid foundation, I mean, because mm-hmm. I look at me, somebody that I mean, I feel like I can read dogs pretty well, but I mean, my plan was to go drop this cocker in the grouse woods with me, and then I'm gonna tune up on that obedience after season's done. And mm-hmm. if I would do that, and I'm sending it back to you and saying, here, Jordan, you know, fix it. I broke it.
Yeah.
What is it? Are you having a really hard time with them when you get them at that point?
Well, so how about I'll use a couple of examples to kind of illustrate okay. how that normally looks. So, and every dog is definitely different for sure. And I mean, that's part of being a trainer is adapting, but generally speaking, so when I steady a dog, which in the flushing world means we want that dog to go in, flush the bird in the air, and then the dog sits. And if the bird is shot, we can send the dog to retrieve the bird. If the bird is missed, we just call the dog off and it goes back to hunting. Right. So that's what we would call a steady flushing dog. When I'm putting them through that steadying process, the way that I do it is I start out with homing pigeons, and I'll have the dog sit on a cato board, and I'll have a bag full of homing pigeons, and I'll let a homing pigeon fly away, and the dog will usually chase it maybe 40 yards or 50 yards. And I just let it chase. I don't call it. I don't yell at it. I just let it chase. And when it comes back, I flick out another homing pigeon. Dog chases it, comes back. I flick out another one, chases it, comes back. And usually after it's chased about five or six of them, you can see the dog starting to get a little bit tired. And it's also starting to realize when it comes back to me, there's another bird. Like maybe I shouldn't run so far, right? Mm-hmm. And once I see the dog starting to think that way, like you can tell the dog is figuring out, if I stay here, there's more birds. Then I'll overlay a verbal command for that dog to stay there. So we use the word HUP, which H-U-P, which is the equivalent of sit for everybody else in the dog world, why do we use HUP? I don't know. But so okay. I'll say HUP. I let the pigeon fly away, and I'll let the pigeon fly over my shoulder. So I'm kind of in between the dog and that pigeon. And normally at this point, the dog it's worked with me enough. It's calm enough. Like, okay, I'll sit here. Pigeon flies away. I tell it it's a good dog. I'll throw a retrieve for it. So I'll pull out a clipping pigeon or a dead pigeon and throw a retrieve for it. It brings it back. Good dog. Back on the cato board. Watch a couple more pigeons fly away. Throw a couple more retrieves for it. So the dog is learning. And I mean, this is going to, I'm sorry, because I'm going to jump all over here. But
no, do it.
When I start with a young dog, like say it's 8 weeks old, 10 weeks old, I want it to, like, I don't care about a young puppy doing a long retrieve. I don't care about it doing anything like spectacular. I'm not trying to like develop a 10-week-old puppy. More, I'm trying to instill a mindset in that dog that behaviors have consequences, whether good or bad. So they learn, if I do this, good things happen. If I do this, good things happen. And they start to learn to offer behaviors in order to get what they want. And that kind of, I mean, I'm sure you're really familiar with clicker training.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that's the concept, right? Oh, if I do this behavior, we're shaping behaviors. So if I do this behavior, there's a click, there's a treat. Mm-hmm. I'll do that behavior again, click, treat, click, treat. And we're teaching that dog basically to work within a set of rules and to offer behaviors and to like interact with us, right? It's really a mindset, and we're developing that mindset. And it's no different. I always like to correlate dog training to people because I think there's so many similarities, but it's no different than with the human brain. Like we can cultivate the human brain and we can shape it and mold it and turn it into like, I mean, there's some kids that because of their environment are much better at learning than other kids that are maybe in a really undisciplined environment. And they're just not so good at learning. It doesn't mean that their brain can't be like, that they can't be helped, I guess would be the word, but environments definitely shape our brains. So I want to shape these puppies' brains so that they learn when I offer the right behavior, I get what I want. When I don't offer the right behavior, I don't get what I want. So a real simple concept, right? But yeah, we miss it often. So that dog now, by the time it's 8 months old and we're going through this, an arbitrary 8 months, but roughly 8 months, it's when it's sitting on that cato board and it watches a pigeon fly away and then it gets to retrieve a pigeon. Like, I understand this concept. When I offer this behavior of sitting here, I get the reward that I want. And when I chase that pigeon 100 yards across the field, I don't get what I want. There was no I never caught that bird and there was no retrieve. But if I stay here, I get the retrieve. So really, it's really a simple concept. And if their brain has been developed the right way, they understand how those concepts work. And that process usually goes really quickly. On the flip side, like I'll use a story here. I sold a puppy to a guy, and it was a pretty high powered breeding. Like they were not going to be like lazy lap dogs that didn't want to hunt. Like, I knew there was a lot of drive in this dog. And the guy came back to me when that puppy was probably about 12 months old, maybe 14 months old. And he wanted to have a training session. So I was, okay, what do you want to work on? He's like, oh, I mean, we don't really need to work on anything. I just kind of want to see how you do things. He already does everything really, really well. We don't really need to work on anything. Okay. So I was like, what happens if I let go of a homing pigeon right now? What'll he do? Oh, he'll just watch it fly away. I'm like, really? Like, did you train him to do that? No, he just does it naturally. So I pulled the homing pigeon out of my bag and I let it go. And this dog chased it till it was like a speck in the distance. And the guy is yelling at it. And like, it was the funniest thing. I had to act like I wasn't laughing, but inside I was laughing. And I mean, the guy was all worked up, and I failed to mention, he had hunted that dog the season before. So it was 8, 9, 10, 11 months old when he hunted it. And he went to a lot of game farms. So the dog had had a lot of birds, and the dog was a puppy when he did that. So the dog was kind of, I mean, it was an adolescent. It wasn't really confident. So it wasn't chasing birds 100 or 200 yards because it didn't have that kind of confidence. But by the time he showed up to my place, the dog loved birds and knew it loved birds. It didn't have a lot of control. And now it had the confidence to just go. So it chases. I've pasture around my property and it's out running around in the pasture way out there. The guy's yelling at it. I'm like, it can't even hear you. Just like, just be quiet. You know? So finally the dog comes back and the guy's got, his veins are kind of popping a little bit in his neck. Like, he's pretty upset. And I was still kind of just enjoying it. So before you could catch the dog, I flicked another pigeon out and he's yelling at it. The dog turns, runs, and we went through the same thing again. And I did it like four or five times.
He didn't yell
times.
At you to like stop throwing the bird.
Oh, I think he was really embarrassed. Okay. But the funny thing was, I really like. It wasn't like I knew it was just really predictable what was going to happen, sure. And I just kind of thought it was funny that he didn't know. And we were training. Like, I'm actually training that dog, even though it's running 200 yards out there chasing this bird. It is being trained because it is figuring out that it's not going to catch that bird. And that's the beauty of pigeons. You know, you don't have to worry about a pigeon landing out in the field. The dog's never going to catch a pigeon once it flies off. But that's typically what I see when a dog comes to me that's already had a hunting season or a couple of hunting seasons. It's out of control. Like you said, my dog is broke, right? Like, he's not hunting for me. He's way too big. He's out of control. It's a lot harder to reel that dog in because with a puppy, it chased that bird 30 yards and then it came back and then it chased 30 yards and then came back and then 20 yards and then 10 yards and then it wasn't chasing. That dog that's a year and a half old has so many bad reps in it and it got away with murder so many times. It takes a lot more to start reeling that dog in. Because once you have that taste of being independent and kind of going rogue, it's hard to give that up. Like, they're feeding off of it. So we can avoid them ever going rogue, I guess you could say.
Right.
Saves a lot of heartache.
Yeah. And that comes with, so in the pointing world, we say, it's easy to pull them in. It's hard to push them out, but with a spaniel, yeah, you don't want them pushed out. Yeah. You don't want them pushed out with a spaniel. So it makes complete sense to do everything. I would call it backwards, but I'm sure.
Yeah. I think you guys are just doing it backwards, but, and the other thing, every dog, again, we're jumping around, but one thing I always tell people, like, if you own that dog, you are a dog trainer and every dog is different. So you can't try to force that dog into the pages of a book or into a podcast or whatever. Like, that dog is a unique individual. So the things that I say, the things that people write, generally speaking, they will typically work, but there's always going to be one-offs, right? And And as a dog trainer, and if you're a dog owner, you're a dog trainer, you do have to be able to adapt to the dog in front of you. So you may have a dog that really doesn't have a lot of drive. It just naturally, it does not have a lot of drive. And if you start putting too much control in that dog at a young age, it may be really hard to get that dog to hunt how you want it to later on. So
right.
you do have to adapt to the dog in front of you. You don't want to just say, boy, my dog is slow and lazy, but I'm going to drill obedience into that dog and then hope that it goes out and hunts. That might not be the best approach, but typically with a well-bred spaniel that we know likes birds, we know it can run, it moves nice. Control is going to be way more important than getting it to go out.
So we use the same method with the pigeons. We do the same thing. And so when are you doing that drill with them? At what age, like, so of your own dogs, what age are they when you're throwing pigeons for them first?
So every dog is different. So we're going to say the average dog here, and mm-hmm. it's one that we'll say that I've owned it since it was 8 weeks old. So it's, I'm not fixing things with it necessarily. I may be fixing things I screwed up. I'm not fixing something somebody else screwed up, but
right.
Usually at say 9 to 10 months old, I might start going through that steadiness process. It might be more like 11 months old with a lot of them.
Wow.
But prior to that, for me personally, I don't like them chasing birds prior to that. I do want them finding some birds depending on the dog's personality, but I'll use a lot of clip-winged pigeons for that. So I can go out in a field and put down a couple of clip-winged pigeons and then bring the dog back through, and it finds the bird, catches it, and brings it back to me. Which you wouldn't want that with a pointer, because we don't want the pointer catching a bird in the field necessarily. But with the flushing dog, I just want them to find them, flush them, and retrieve them. Well, if the bird can't fly, I want them to find it, catch it, and bring it back to me. And so it's catching birds, it's learning to use its nose, but it's not getting bad reps of, i.e. chasing a bird across the field because the bird can't fly. And then let's say I go out there with a 7 or 8 month old puppy, and that thing, like, it knows there's birds in the field and it wants to go, and it just starts staring across the field. Well, that's a problem, right? Like, now we've got a young dog that's already figuring out that if it goes away from me, it's going to find birds. So at that point, we're not going to have birds in the field anymore, because I don't want that dog figuring out if it goes 200 yards away from me, it can find birds still. I want it to think birds are always within that like 20 to 25 yard range from me. So what I'll do then, maybe I'll go out and act like I'm putting out birds in the field, or, you know, we simulate it like everything's normal, but the birds are actually just in my bag. So now when the dog starts to head down the field and it's too far away, I'll put in a bird closer to me, like 10 feet away from me. And I'll call the dog back in and put it right on the bird. And, you know, we're starting to condition that behavior. Oh, birds are in close. When he blows his whistle, the guy seems to always know when there's a bird there, right? And that's what the dog starts thinking. But I'm really only doing that with clip-winged birds up until I go through that steadiness process, which is somewhere in that 10, 11-month-old range. For you, I mean, if you get a cocker or a flusher of any sort, you're not planning on field trialing. So steadiness really is optional at that point. I mean, you may say, I want a really polished flushing dog, and I want to train it to the highest level, so it's going to be steady. And that's awesome. Nothing says you have to do that, though. You may just want a flushing dog that when it flushes a bird, if the bird isn't shot, like let's say it's a hen pheasant, or you miss the bird, which probably never happens, right? But maybe you do, or, you know, whatever. I don't want the dog chasing it 200 yards. That's a little bit easier to train, but But the steadiness process fixes all those issues, right? Like a steady dog is never going to chase a bird across the field.
Right. Right. So on that note, I'm really curious to get your insight on this. So I feel like some of our best dogs are the ones that are very independent. So I would say our best hunting dogs, like the ones we really enjoy hunting over, they lack a little bit of that cooperation, obedient, and I shouldn't say obedience. I'd say more cooperation and possibly trainability just because they're always on. They're always ready to go and do something, not hold still. Whereas like some of our dogs that are the most well-accomplished, highest titles are really, they're extremely trainable, very obedient, super cooperative, but they're not necessarily the ones that I personally enjoy hunting over. You know, they can accomplish all the titles because they have those great characteristics, but they aren't the ones that have that, I don't know, that passion, that grit, that edginess that I really enjoy out in the field with me.
That's totally true of the Spaniel. Totally. Okay. I mean, those are like verbatim the words that I have said to people about Spaniels. So it's funny you're saying that. Is that tied into gender at all? Or is that just no correlation to gender?
No correlation. I just like, there were like our first three dogs that we had at the NAVDA Invitational, like just some of the, you know, coolest dog, best dogs we've ever hunted over, but like they just couldn't keep it together because it's basically a huge obedience test and they need to be at heel all the time. And I'm just like, you know, it might have earned its VC today, but this is, I'm ready to hunt this dog at the top of my line tomorrow. So,
yeah.
I mean, what about for you?
I definitely see that. I would say, so I have two national champions, Breeze and Cato. One is a much better wild bird dog than the other. I've also found in the Spaniels, the females seem to be better wild bird hunters than the males. Like the males seem to be more content to do exactly what they're told. Whereas the females seem to be, I use the word creative, like they seem to be a little bit more creative with their hunting. And it doesn't always look
intelligent. That just creative. Comes with having two X creative. Chromosomes, but okay, yeah.
So many jokes right now, will not take the bait. We'll just plow ahead. So some of my friends, when they heard I was going to be on the Bird Dog Babe podcast, had some funny comments, and so many I wanted to repeat, and then I can't do it.
Do it. So. No, do it. It's good.
No, won't do it. Won't take the bait. But it very well may be intel. I don't know. But the females do see, interestingly enough, because you think of the males being like hard charging pounders, like, you know, more like aggression, not like angry aggression, but just like a more physical type dog, right?
Sure.
But the females in my experience will go longer than the males will. They typically seem to be better at like just figuring out wild birds and finding them. And the males, like I have a couple, like I have Rocky, who now he's almost 11 years old, so he doesn't do a lot anymore, but he's placed second at a nationals. He's hunted his whole life. I mean, he's hunted all across the Midwest. And I think he's finished three nationals, which is, he's an accomplished trial dog and he's a full sister to Breeze. And then I have Rocky, and then I have Cato, and Cato's won the nationals. Both of those dogs, like if we went hunting, you would probably, well, maybe not you, but the average person would be like mesmerized by how smooth they are and how they just do what they're supposed to do and just run nice. And then I'll put Breeze down, and Breeze is like, she can be a little bit frustrating at times. I mean, she'll pull your chain a little bit. And she's a little bit more independent than I would like, but it won't necessarily look good. But she does find way more birds than the males do. And I have another female, Gandy, who is, she's the same way. Like it doesn't always look pretty, but she just has like more, I'm going to go back to the word creativity. Like they're just more creative in how they attack the cover, and they, sure. they don't seem to get beat up like the males do. You know, some of the grouse cover we go in has a lot of thorns and gnarly stuff, and the males will, you know, they'll be all tore up in the face, and the females come out and they look like they just put their makeup on, you know, they're all like, they're all cute still. And the males are dripping blood. And, but the females have done just as much work. They just attacked it differently than the males did. So
yeah, interesting.
I definitely, but you know, it goes back with the spaniels. There's still that balance of, I want some independence. I want some, I mean, I sure don't want to be directing a bird, a dog the whole time I'm hunting with it. Like I just want it to go hunt. And if I want to put it in a certain spot, I sure want it to listen to the whistle. You know, I want it to give me ground and listen to me when I want it to listen to me. But the rest of the time, I want it to be an independent, hard charging hunting dog. So there's some balance there, but ultimately, like if that dog isn't hunting for me in some capacity, it's probably going to be a really frustrating hunt. And it's been 25 years since my original Cato. And I still have like vivid memories of running after that dog, trying to keep up with it while it was flushing birds up ahead of me and being so frustrated. And that probably like dictated the rest of my life. Like that's probably why the pendulum swung so far to the other side. Like that was not fun. So many ruined hunts, so many birds that got away because the dog flushed them out of range. Like, let's not ever do that again. And, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so do you find yourself like choosing the like Breeze or Gandy as your choice that you, the dogs that you would pull out first that you really enjoy hunting over because they have a little bit more of that independence?
So
creativity?
That actually kind of depends on where I'm hunting. So if I feel like I'm going into a really game-rich environment and it's going to be a shorter hunt, I might pull out Rocky or Cato. If I'm going somewhere where I think maybe it's not going to be quite so game-rich, you know, we're going to have to go a little bit farther and not find nearly as many birds, then I'm more inclined to pull out one of the females.
Okay.
Because I figure they may get a little farther out than the males. They may... Yeah, they're going to be a little bit more creative, and I typically find they're going to produce birds in those situations better than the males will.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that they're more likely to come apart if there's like a lot of bird action going on, like that their control string is just a little bit shorter?
So funny. I am painting with a pretty broad brush here, but. Mm-hmm. But the males may actually like come apart, I guess, more like they may actually like that whole eyes roll back into the head, lose their mind sort of thing. The females, I don't think it's so much that they come apart. I think it's that they're devious little things and they take advantage. Like they figure out like when they can take ground, you know, when they can get away with stuff. And it's not sure. And it's more calculated than the males, I think. If that makes any sense at all, but like in training, I'll have the males typically are more honest in training. Like they do what they're supposed to do and they just enjoy doing it and whatever you want, boss. And, that's good. And the females, they tend to be more like trying to manipulate the rules and checking to see if the rules are the same today. And it's not coming apart as in I lost my mind and I don't know what I'm doing. It's more being devious. It's so funny. This seems like a great podcast to tell this story. So you said you can edit things out. So feel free.
But I can. Okay.
So add it to your list. It's probably already there. But when I got my very first cocker, I called the guy that I was going to get it from. I called him up and he said, yeah, I'm going to have a litter in a few months. And you can get on the list. And he's like, do you want a male or a female? And I said I'd like a female, and he said, okay, well, like, why do you want a female? And I had no idea what I was doing. And he's like, well, aren't the females a little bit easier to train? And he goes, they are. And I was like, well, I mean, are they? I don't know. Are they? And he's like, well, he's like, you know why they call them bitches, right? And that's always stuck with me, because there was way more truth to that than what I realized at the time. Like, they are devious.
Right.
But if you can manage it, I think they're, in my experience, a little bit better humming dogs. Yeah. For me, anyway.
I'm probably
just traded the extra demand on female cockers, which there's already a shortage. So kudos to me.
No, well, and it has to take, you know, a really dedicated person to, it sounds like, to have them at that level, though. I mean, to be able to keep that under control. So
yeah, I was gonna say, for a lot of people, a male probably is a better choice, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think across the board then, because when people ask the differences between male and females with my breed, the German Wirehair Pointer, I tell them about the same that you just described, that where, like, you know, the males are more likely to just cuddle with you if you want them to, where the bitches are like, I'll come to you if I want it. And you know, like, and my husband prefers the females because he thinks that they mature early on, and they hold it together, where the males take a while to get to the level where he likes them, but they hold it together eventually. He just doesn't. Mm-hmm. He likes a dog that's serious and ready to work early on. Would you agree?
I can definitely see.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see. So the females, I think, maybe get bored with training faster than the males do. So if you're doing more repetitive training, I think it takes a little more skill with the females than it does with the males. But just like raw maturity, like I think part of the reason they don't train quite as well is because they did mature faster and they're bored by repetitive stuff. Like so if you were focusing more on hunting than training, I can definitely see an advantage there with the females. If you're focusing more on training than hunting, the male might actually, you know, you might almost in your mind think, well, the male matured faster than the female, but it's really like the male is just more easily entertained with simple things.
Mm-hmm. What's your,
just with dogs though.
Uh-huh.
Carry on.
What's your personal feeling on hunting cockers, or I should just be general, hunting a flusher and a pointer together?
So I don't espouse to the idea of like letting dogs learn from other dogs, really. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to take out a pointer and a flusher and like hope that two poorly trained ones and hope that they somehow figure out together that, hey, you do that job and I'll do this job and it'll be awesome. So I think it can definitely be done, but I would want one of those dogs to be really well trained before I introduce the other. And really, I probably would want the pointer to be the one that's really well trained and then work the cocker up into it, because I mean, some of these dogs are really, really competitive in any breed. So if a competitive pointer sees a flusher flushing its bird and retrieving it, and you could create some issues with that pointer. But I think if you've got a well-trained pointer that isn't going to get frustrated giving up the flush and the retrieve to a spaniel or to a flusher, and if you have a flusher that isn't out of control and that you can bring it in and send it in to flush in front of that pointer, I think that can be a really awesome experience and a great combination. But you definitely want to train those dogs separately before you put them together.
Mm-hmm.
That probably went without saying.
But I haven't seen the combination look amazing yet. I know it's out there.
Okay.
I know, I know it can happen, and I'm really anxious to see that combination. But and I guess only a couple of times personally that I've hunted or been with a flushing dog, and my pointers, you know, whether they're not trained enough, it could be the problem. But I just wonder how many more times that pointing dog is going to allow that bird to be flushed before it just stops pointing, because, you know, it just, oh, that's how we get the bird, is if you go chase it type of thing.
Right.
And then it's being
shot. And I don't have, I mean, you're the pointing dog expert, so I'll rely on you for that one. But the flusher will gladly keep flushing in front of that pointer.
Sure. Right. Right.
So, no, but I agree. I would think, and I, you know, probably for any of your listeners that have both or are considering both, they're probably, I mean, maybe it's too big of an assumption, but you probably have some experience and you probably know what you're doing. You probably can train a dog if you're adding multiple dogs to your string. So, I mean, I would want to be reading that pointer. Hey, is it getting frustrated? Am I starting to see issues pop up? And if that's happening, then I probably want to back off. But on the other hand, a lot of pointers don't like to retrieve that much. So how is it different sending a cocker in to flush the bird than you going in to flush the bird? Either way, the pointer wasn't flushing. And if it didn't really care about retrieving to begin with, who cares that the cocker's retrieving? So, right. I think for a lot That's of pointers, point. It would probably be a non-issue.
Right.
But
right. The pointers and
maybe, every situation's unique.
Yeah. Yeah, true. I think the more ideal combination, you're right, would be pointer setter and a flusher. Then maybe like instead of the versatile breeds, like a wire hair, short hair, Vizsla, the ones that just overthink every situation and try to escape around it going, okay, that thing's going to take my birds. Well, then I'm just going to go in and get it.
Yeah. Just run the flusher with the male dog that won't overthink it.
Carries that Y chromosome. They'll get them every time.
The hole is just getting deeper.
So let's circle around, because we're at about an hour here, but I do want to, I had some training questions, and maybe that's just going to have to be for a different podcast in general. But so the Kato board and helping with the issue of the dog that on the retrieve likes to parade around, and how awesome utilizing that place board in, you know, in general, to be able to clean up that retrieve, giving that dog the object of this is exactly where you need to come back to and present the bird. Do you want to touch on that a little bit? I don't need to keep going on.
Yeah, sure. So interesting. I mean, the training can get so complex, even though it's so simple at its root, but a lot of times when that dog is coming back parading around, it may be because it's actually parading around and showing it off. It also may be because it feels a little bit of pressure coming into you. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to anthropomorphize, right? Like we like to put human characteristics on that dog. Like, do dogs really show off like that? Well, yeah, maybe they do. But a lot of times it's because that dog isn't comfortable just coming in, because maybe you've been really grabby in the past. You squared your shoulders up, like you've made it unintentionally, but you've made it uncomfortable for that dog to come in and give you the object. So it may actually be the pressure that's causing it to do that parading around. So with the platform, and I'll use the Kato board just in the generic sense. So with the Kato board, if that dog from early on learned that good things happened on that Kato board and that there was no pressure associated with it, there was only reward associated with it, when it's coming back with that object and it sees the Kato board, it's coming back to a familiar, comfortable spot that never changes. And that's a lot easier for a dog. Whereas if I'm calling the dog back to me, I'm a living being. I change, my tone of voice changes, my volume changes, the angle of my shoulders change, my arms extending and retracting. I mean, there's a lot of things going on with people that we're not aware of necessarily because we just do them naturally that can cause discomfort to the dog, like not physical discomfort, but just mental discomfort. Like if you think about, I've used this on other podcasts with other people. I always call it like it's like the 100-pound gorilla hand. If you think about a little puppy coming back with a tennis ball in its mouth, and here's you know, some guy's hand or some woman's hand coming to take that ball out of the dog's mouth, and the hand is like twice the size of their head, and we don't think of it like, oh, we're just happy the dog's doing its thing and we're just going to take the ball from its mouth. Now if you imagine like if you were retrieving a ball, I mean, this is kind of whatever extreme, but let's say you were the one retrieving and it was a 2000 pound person and you came back and that 2000 pound person was going to put their hand into your face and take something out of your mouth. Like that'd be a little bit awkward, right? I mean, that's not as simple as we think it is for that dog. So if I can put that cato board there and I call the dog back into the cato board, so my shoulders, and hopefully you have a camera on me right now because I'm actually like acting this out as I'm talking over the phone.
Don't.
No. Okay. So I'll do my best here. So I'm sideways to the cato board. I'm squared up with the cato board, but okay. The dog is off to my side. So the dog's coming across in front of me onto the cato board. So my shoulders never squared up to the dog. They were always turned sideways. In a more, not necessarily submissive, but not in an aggressive stance, right? So I'm turned sideways and I'm just calling the dog back onto that platform. And the platform generates no stress for that dog because the platform doesn't change the volume of its voice. It doesn't move around. It doesn't get grabby. It's just a platform. It's just a cato board sitting there. It's comfortable for that dog to hop onto. So it runs back, jumps on the cato board. I can pet it, tell it it's a good dog. And then as an afterthought, I take the ball away from that dog without it really even thinking about it. I have found for the majority of dogs doing that, just that process right there cleans up so much of that parading because it right. took away the stress of the handoff, right? Mm-hmm. That was a really long explanation for
no,
thing,
it was, but. It was perfect. It makes total sense.
So think about this, like if we can throw a ball or a bird or whatever 40 yards and that dog runs out as fast as it can and it turns and it runs back. And then when it gets 10 feet away from us, things start getting screwy where maybe the dog drops the ball or it runs around us. You know, why can that dog run all the way out and then 95% of the way back and then then things fall apart? Well, the only thing that it's us, right? It's the bubble around us.
Yep.
So we just need to change that bubble. We need to make it so it doesn't get stressful. It's not awkward for that dog to come into our bubble.
Right.
So the dog is telling you when it does that stuff, it's telling you that there's something wrong with your bubble.
Right. And I think of the things that we do, you know, when they're puppies, when they're grabbing the kid's socks and we're chasing after them and ripping it out of their mouth and telling them, you know, no, and how much they're relating it to that is every time I come to you, you're just taking things away from me and yelling at me. So yeah, I think it's helpful to be more aware of how we handle those situations. It's like the dog running away and finally comes back and then yelling at it. You know, they didn't learn that I was wrong for running away. They just learned I'm getting yelled at for coming back to you. So, but yeah, that's another
There's
podcast.
Lots of little things. it's all about like being a dog trainer. You know, I'll use the illustration. Like if you have a kid, you're a parent. Mm-hmm. And if you have a dog, you're a dog trainer. You know, like that's just how it, that's how it is. If you can't, you know, it always frustrates me when people say like, I'm not really a dog trainer, but I have a dog. Well, no, you may be a really bad dog trainer, but you actually are training a dog if you own a dog, whether you want to train it or not. So a lot of it is like, hey, like just wake up, realize you're a dog trainer because you own a dog and you don't need to do it perfectly and you don't have to do it exhaustively. You know, you don't have to train for 2 hours a day, but just be really intentional about what you're doing. And if you're having an issue, like, one, be honest that you're having an issue, but then work your way through it, like problem solve, figure out what do I need to do to change this? And there might be five different answers to your problem, but find one that works for you and change. You know, if you're having a problem with your dog, most likely it's heavily tied into environment. You know, somehow it's tied into your interaction or something that that dog is doing. So think about it logically. What can I change in the environment? What can I change in my interaction with that dog? What can I do to fix that issue? And it's not rocket science, and it's not like some abstract, like, I mean, it's all really pretty logical if we just sit down and think through it and, you know, put on our dog trainer hat.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right.
That's my soapbox.
I like it. We'll end on your soapbox note.
Okay.
Jordan, how can people find you?
The main way to reach me now is through Cato Outdoors. So if you go to Cato Outdoors or Cato Boards at both of those, so catooutdoors.com, that'll take you to my website. And I'm really the dog training, I'm not taking on client dogs anymore or doing private sessions. I'm really focusing on the platform side. I mean, I'll answer questions as best I can. I do throw out videos every once in a great while. So, yeah, I mean, the best way to find me, go to catooutdoors.com. I guess that's the short answer.
Okay. And on Instagram?
Yeah, I do have an Instagram page. So if you search for Cato Outdoors, and Cato is spelled C-A-T-O, Cato. So yeah, you can find me on Facebook or Instagram just by looking for Cato Outdoors.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jordan. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a fun time. I hope you enjoyed it.
I sure did.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.